From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, a new year and a new start. I share my first of the year commentary about the glass half full for Latinos in 2014 and why Latinos are saying, se acabó. We're taking things into our own hands and establishing our own agenda because we can transform ourselves.
What I discovered is that once I came out of the jungle, part of myself stayed hiding and I became a new person, like something different.
We follow a dancer on his journey from a remote Mayan community to the streets of Manhattan. Plus, a Chicano rock and roll mystery.
Julian Herrera showed up and he said, "Hi, everybody, I'm Julian Herrera." I grabbed the microphone and everybody stopped and looked because they knew who he was.
And more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And we here at Latino USA wanted to start off the new year by sharing some of our thoughts about what's coming up in 2014. The truth is, I call the times Latinos are living in this country the U.S. Mambo. Three steps forward and two steps back. Sometimes I tend to see the glass half empty, but I actively try to fight against that. So I did a little bit of reporting, and it turns out that if you talk to young Latinos now, many say 2014 is going to be a great year. I'm still recuperating from the whiplash of disappointment on the immigration reform front, but even there, young Latinos say they're reshaping the narrative of their lives in this country. And the engagement of young Latinos in all aspects of American society is one of the best things that can happen to our country. Given our growth rates, in 25 years, how these now youthful Latinos feel and act upon every aspect of our society is not going to impact just them, but all of us. So how they feel about democracy, the Constitution, due process, public protest, the tax system, voter ID requirements, abortion, women's rights, poverty. How Latinos, as the fastest growing demographic group in our country, feel about all this is going to matter to all of us. About that whiplash due to the lack of immigration reform, just think about these numbers. One in four Latinos knows someone who's been detained or deported. According to Pew, 6 in 10 Latinos worry a lot that they or someone they know could be deported. I mean, come on. If you're Latino, you know that any official could ask you anywhere, anytime about your status. And you know the same doesn't go for many other Americans. New polls say that relief from deportation is more important than even a pathway to citizenship to 55% of this country's Latinos. But they also say that an overwhelming number of Latinos, 89%, favor a congressional pathway to citizenship for the undocumented. When I ran into Cokie Roberts at the airport in Washington, D.C., she put it very simply, the way good politicians do. When I asked her what she thought about the lack of reform, she said, "The message is, we like you or we don't like you." And right now, I would venture to say that many Latinos and immigrants feel unliked. And with 2013 being a year of protests, hunger strikes, blockades of government offices, shutting down of streets, candlelight vigils at detention centers, it was a year of pushing for change that didn't happen. That makes Latinos feel unliked too. Which is why I was so happy to hear from Latino millennials that since no one is going to do anything for them, they're going to have to do it all for themselves. And that is the essence of democracy. Not to pull your bootstraps up and make money. No, get your history and get engaged with all aspects of our society. Participatory democracy, with or without papers. Democracy always ebbs and flows, ¿que no? So, if last year was the ebb, mi gente, then this year it's going to flow. And that is good for everyone. because we want to dispel the image of the sad Latino, but we won't be afraid to tell the truth, and the truth may make you sad. But as the young people I've talked to make clear, the narrative about Latinos for 2014 is para arriba. We have the social capital and a $1 trillion market behind us. Para arriba, Latino USA. And that means all of us.
La primera declaración de la selva lacandona.
Nosotros hoy decimos basta. Somos los herederos de los verdaderos portadores de nuestra nacionalidad. Nosotros armados para hacer una revolución. ¡Viva la revolución!
This was the face of the modern-day Mexican Revolution becoming public, an opening declaration from La Selva Lacandona, the Lacandon jungle, marking the start of the remarkable uprising 20 years ago in the southern Mexican province of Chiapas. On January 1, 1994, some 1,500 armed Mayan people took over the city halls of a half dozen towns in Chiapas. They called themselves the Zapatista National Liberation Army. In Spanish, El Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, named after Emiliano Zapata, one of the principal leaders of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, who championed land rights and peasants' rights. The campesinos in the Zapatista army, known by its initials EZLN, said they were fighting against government corruption and constant armed repression against the indigenous by the Mexican army. They saw NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was going into effect that very same New Year's Day, as the final straw.
Luchan por salud, educación, independencia, tierra, paz, libertad, democracia. Bueno, hay muchas cosas, pues,
que sí lo vas a conseguir.
Con las armas sí se consigue.
Very quickly, because of their hopeful brashness and their media-savvy tactics, the EZLN quickly became a symbol for a new Latin American revolution. The men and women were equals, all exuded a humility and at the same time extraordinary power. And there was a certain pipe-smoking intellectual at the front of it all. His nom de guerre, Subcomandante Marcos. He spoke with 60 Minutes' Ed Bradley in 1994 and explained why he joined the Zapatistas.
You must choose a way in one stage of your life. You believe in some kind of right of the people. You think that the people have the right of justice, of liberty, of democracy, and you decide to fight for these people.
The story of the Zapatistas became an important one for Latino USA as well. At the time, we'd been on the air less than a year when the uprising happened.
They suffer an anguish that has driven them to this movement. They feel they no longer have a viable, peaceful option.
After 2 weeks of intense confrontation with the Mexican army, the Zapatistas brokered a peace agreement with the federal government. Now, 20 years later, the media attention has faded, but the Zapatista communities have endured. They control several autonomous sectors in Chiapas, with indigenous-run local government and schools. But many of the problems that led them to take up arms continue. In the municipality of San Andres Larrainsar, where the peace accords were signed, it's estimated that 8 in 10 people go hungry, which is a higher proportion than in 1993, before the armed struggle started. For many Latinos, getting in touch with your roots means exploring the culture of your country of birth or that of your parents. For dancer and choreographer Javier Jul, it means going back even further. Jul was raised as a ritual dancer in a remote Mayan community in Mexico. Today, he lives in Manhattan and runs his own dance company. And this is his story of his remarkable journey in his own words.
I was raised in the jungle in Mexico, in the state of Campeche. My family comes from very old tradition, Mayan culture. What a person in Mexico will say, chamanes. It's a family of priests that they kind of preserve the Mayan culture from family to family. And for them, you have to understand the nature and be part of it. You don't have a house, basically. The jungle is your house. When I was 15, I was performing a ceremony, and there was an anthropologist, very important in Mexico. He came to watch some ceremonies. He talked to my father and he said, I think this kid has talent for dance. So this man brought me to the city and he took me to this company, which is a very big folklore company in Mexico. When I was on the stage and I started performing the ritual, I felt that the energy that I was creating, it wasn't connecting with the audience that it was watching. So after having that experience, I decided that I wanted to learn to dance the way people appreciate it. Later on, I was offered a scholarship to come to New York to study at the Martha Graham Contemporary School and ended up dancing in the company for like about 10 years. What I discovered is that once I came out of the jungle, part of myself stayed hiding, and I became a new person, like a new, like something different. When you live in the jungle, you become alone. You're like this animal that relates with the universe, with nature. And when you're in the city, you become this animal that deals with other persons like you. When I was dancing with other companies, I never shared where I was from. I think the farthest that I say is I'm from Mexico, because it was very different. Like I grew up naked. I didn't say that to anybody. I grew up with animals. I will not say that to anybody because they will look at me and say, you're crazy. Or I understood very fast that if I say those kind of things, it wasn't good. Because I danced with all these companies. In all these companies, I felt that I did not have a voice. Like I felt that I was a color in a painting. And then I had the necessity of doing my own thing. And I created a company called Soul Dance. First, for some reason, I started using the formula of the dance that I learned. So I would use ballet, I would use modern. And then I felt that I wasn't being honest. And then I just started moving the way I moved before. And somehow I feel that on the last years, like that Mayan came out and say, oh, this is my body. I want to use it again. Now when I do Mayan dancing with my company, I feel that the audience is open. And at the end, my company and the audience connect in some point, some level.
Coming up, a county in Texas with one of the highest rates of migrant deaths.
They have a lot of, you know, insects. They're missing limbs, they're missing fingers, they're missing toes, they're missing, you know, their eyeballs are gone.
They come with a dream. Many of them just don't make it. Stay with us on Latino USA.
Dividir el mar por la...
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And in our country, we have to come to terms with the fact that we live with people who have put their lives at risk just to be here. Take a minute to talk to a day laborer or the person delivering your food or cleaning your garden and ask them about the trip they made to El Norte. Sometimes they don't even want to remember it because the journey was so traumatic. The survivors live among us. And now, increasingly heavy enforcement in cities and along the Arizona border have made South Texas the new hotspot for unauthorized entries. One of the highest migrant death rates in the nation is in rural Brooks County, Texas, 70 miles north of the border. From there, Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
The evidence of illegal immigration is hidden in a tangled cove of mesquite trees on the edge of a South Texas ranch. Dangling bras, backpacks, tuna fish can wrappers, and gallon after gallon of plastic water jugs.
And the reason you see all this trash here is because, and this is about the only way that I can impress on you on what is happening out here.
Lavosier Durham is a tall, square-shouldered rancher who manages 13,000 acres on El Tule Ranch in Brooks County. It sits off U.S. Highway 281, the main road that runs north from the border. Driving his pickup across the ranch, Durham says every week, hundreds of immigrants trek across this land.
It's rough country. You got coyotes, you got snakes, insects.
But people come through anyway to avoid a Border Patrol checkpoint on the main highway. In the summer, temperatures can rise above 100 degrees. There is little shade to protect from the stinging sun, and the ground is covered in thorny brush. If you get in trouble out here, the land is merciless.
You know, people have given up, and they're crawling to my house and knocking on my door, and please give me water, and please give me food.
For most of these immigrants, ranch land in Brooks County is near the end of a treacherous journey across thousands of miles. Almost half of them are coming from Central American countries like Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Drug and gang violence in that region is pushing people to flee. And South Texas is the most direct route from Central America to the United States.
Bueno, entonces vamos a comenzar. Esta señora se llama Luz.
In an online video, Durham interviews one of the immigrants who ended up on his doorstep. He speaks Spanish thanks to his Mexican mother.
I'm just telling Luz, her name is Luz. She comes from Guatemala.
The video is stark, with Durham sitting legs crossed in a cowboy hat next to a woman in a gray sweatshirt and a dazed expression. He posts these videos on YouTube so, in his words, all the gringos can understand what's happening.
She said that she sold her house. ¿Qué tanto dinero en dólares vendiste la casa?
Luz tells Durham she sold her home in Guatemala to pay a smuggler to take her to San Antonio. When Durham asks why she made the journey, she breaks down in tears.
Les quieres dar el estudio. Futuro mejor. ¿No hay trabajo en Guatemala?
I want to give my two daughters in Guatemala a better future, she tells Durham. Back home, she says, armed gangs extort you and threaten to kill your family. But death is also a possibility on the journey north. At the Brooks County Cemetery, Chief Deputy Benny Martinez of the local sheriff's department maneuvers his truck under a canopy of oak trees.
This is where I have my mom and dad spot right here, one of my sisters and my aunt right here.
This is also where the unidentified remains of migrants are buried. The graves are adorned with bright plastic flowers and a simple metal plaque marked unknown. 3 years ago, Brooks County recovered the bodies of 20 dead immigrants. Last year, the number of bodies shot up to 129.
And I really don't have the words to really describe what they look like. They have a lot of, you know, insects. They're missing limbs. They're missing fingers. They're missing toes. They're missing, you know, their eyeballs are gone.
Sometimes the dead will carry IDs or scraps of paper with a relative's phone number. In those cases, the county will work with the migrant's home country to repatriate the remains. Forensics experts at two Texas universities are trying to identify the rest through DNA testing.
This process will help us enormously to relocate the bodies.
It cost the county nearly $200,000 last year to bury these bodies. Martinez says there are also smugglers who operate immigrant stash houses within the county and run trucks full of people to major cities like Houston. Martinez says the work is getting overwhelming. He only has five deputies.
It's kind of difficult to kind of maintain that presence, but yeah, we do.
But it's the migrant deaths that weigh heaviest on his conscience.
Since they don't belong here and since they're not documented, we tend to criminalize them.
Martinez says that makes it easier for people to ignore the deaths.
But you know what? They're on U.S. soil. So it becomes our issue now. And this is where we need to step up and start doing something more proactive to where we can avoid this death out here.
For now, human rights groups that have been working in the Arizona desert for years are beginning to help here. This summer, they installed Brooks County's first remote water station. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe, reporting from Falfurrias, Texas.
Having one of the highest rates of migrant deaths has attracted other types of border activity to Brooks County as well. Reporter Amy Bracken spent time with another group of volunteers, this one taking it upon itself to control the border and stop the migrants.
One of the first things you see when you walk into Mike Vickers' veterinary office is a cartoon poster of a man in cowboy boots kicking a scrawny President Obama out of his state. In big red letters are the words, "Don't mess with Texas." Vickers says people in Washington don't get what he's living through.
I could see how it'd be very difficult for anybody in the rest of the United States to have any idea that all of this is going on down here.
What's going on is that South Texas has seen a dramatic jump in illegal border crossings, as the numbers have dropped in the other hotspot, Arizona. The deaths here in Brooks County hit a record high in 2012.
129 bodies showing up on private property in one Texas county, 15 minutes in any direction from my front door where I live.
Vickers collects the evidence. On his desk is a big pile of blown-up photos of young men and women, most of them dead.
We found this guy and see all the blood coming out of his eyes. The birds plucked his eyes out before he died. He bled out.
The migrants are from all over the world. They cross the Rio Grande where the U.S. border dips far south, creating the shortest distance from Central America. Many get a ride from the border up Highway 281. But then, 70 miles north, here in the Brooks County seat of Falfurrias, they face a Border Patrol checkpoint. Undocumented travelers avoid it by sneaking around on foot through desert ranches. They walk through deep, fine sand littered with cacti and snakes, often in deadly heat.
Back in the old days, in the 70s and 80s, you know, early 80s, we had a little bit of traffic, but they were real respectful Mexican peasants coming in for a job, and they'd come ring the doorbell or knock on the door and ask if we have work, ask if they could use the water hose. You know, if they were hungry, we'd give them food. If they needed some clothing, we'd give them clothes. And now it's transcended into complete lawlessness. Huge groups, a lot of gang members in the group, you know, and we live in a life-threatening situation 24/7 now.
In 2006, Vickers founded the Texas Border Volunteers. Their mission is to help the Border Patrol intercept illegal border crossers. Some of its 300 members meet several times a year to do night patrols.
Jen, and you get Tang T8.
This evening, about 30 of them are gathered in camo outfits and Kevlar rattlesnake shin guards outside the Vickers' ranch house. The volunteers, who use code names, are getting their orders for the night.
Gumbo ball has a thermal and M33.
Just before sunset, the men and one woman take off in a fleet of ATVs. They branch off in different directions, sliding around in the sand, then finally settle among the trees where they can see common migrant routes like fences and power lines. Darkness falls, and the sophisticated night vision gear comes out. The gear costs thousands of dollars apiece and is paid for by ranchers, volunteers, and supporters they meet at gun shows.
Gumbo just reported 14 from the position down there.
The volunteers call Border Patrol to report the sighting of 14 so-called criminal trespassers. But it turns out to be human error.
So what were you guys laughing at?
Oh, the 14 that Gumball reported were cows. Yeah.
Have you ever heard the term fog of war?
That's Ralph Lang, a longtime volunteer from Midland, Texas. He looks up at the sky, velvety black and full of stars. There's a merciful, cool breeze.
I live a rather hectic life as a civilian, and this is good therapy for me to just go out and sit in the night.
Lang worried he'd be expelled from the Texas Border Volunteers when the others found out he'd voted for Obama in 2008. But he says he feels more Texan than American, and he's here because he wants to stop bad guys like smugglers from coming in. He and Vickers have both traveled south of the border and know that many people come across to flee poverty and gang violence. But in the end, Vickers says, they're all lawbreakers because they've entered the country illegally and they're trespassing on private property.
In the last 8 years, has there ever been a moment when you thought, maybe I shouldn't be doing this anymore?
Oh, yeah. I've had some weak moments, you know, where I thought, God, I feel so sorry for this person. I'd love to let him go, but I'm not going to. I had him beg and beg and beg. And, you know, it's you become calloused.
This is the last patrol for a few weeks. Most of the volunteers will drive hundreds of miles home to jobs or families. They've nabbed no one tonight, but they recount the times they've saved people. Here's a volunteer named Tom, a.k.a. Polecat.
I reported a group of two men, one woman, and Borpo arrested one of the men, one of the women. But he actually did get three because the woman had a brand new little baby under her jacket. And I long thought that we probably saved that baby's life.
But these people are not humanitarians. They say they're driven by concerns over jobs, use of public services, disease transmission, and terrorism. None of the volunteers I've spoken with say they joined to save immigrants' lives. After a night out with the border volunteers, I hit a Falfurrias taqueria for breakfast. There, I happened to run into a man named Eduardo Canales.
¿Qué tal?
Canales, I find out, is a volunteer of a different sort. He's a longtime labor organizer and immigrant rights advocate. He's here in Brooks County trying to set up a search and rescue organization for immigrants. I ask him why he thinks the Texas Border Volunteers' efforts aren't enough.
Well, all that is geared towards apprehensions. It is not geared towards saving lives and trying to prevent people from dying out there. Our endeavor is to try to find those people that are stragglers, left behind, have injuries, need first aid, and have given up, and hopefully we can bring them in and save their lives.
Canales has been installing a few water stations along migration routes. He'd like to put an emergency number into the hands of smugglers so they can call when they leave someone in the desert. And he wants search and rescue workers to be able to go onto ranch land to find people in distress. But this isn't Arizona, where the desert is mostly public land. Here, Canales needs permission from ranchers, like Mike Vickers. He says he's gotten some cooperation, but it's still a work in progress. For Latino USA, I'm Amy Bracken, Falfurrias, Brooks County, Texas.
And now to the deportees themselves. Sometime soon, if it hasn't happened already, the number of deportations since President Obama entered office will hit the 2 million mark, a record number. Combine that with the two stories we just gave you from Texas, and it seemed like a good time to replay a story we aired early last year. Mexican deportees are often released into border cities, at night, into places they've never been to where they know no one. Maria Inés Zamudio, a journalist with the Chicago Reporter, traveled to Matamoros, Mexico, to find out more just what this feels like.
It is Wednesday morning. I'm standing at the U.S. side of the international bridge that connects Brownsville, Texas, to Matamoros, Mexico. And in a couple of minutes, I'll be crossing the border.
The contrast from the quiet settings of Brownsville, Texas, into Matamoros is striking. Here, Mexican soldiers patrol the streets with assault rifles. And shootouts between rival cartels often paralyze the city.
I'm afraid.
Reynaldo Hernandez was deported from Illinois a few months ago. I meet him outside the bus station in Matamoros. This is his second day here.
I couldn't sleep all night thinking about it. They can kidnap me because they think I'm coming from up north, and I have money with me.
Hernandez is with a new friend, Eduardo Ruiz, a deportee from Indiana. The men are stranded here with no means to get back to their hometowns, more than 500 miles away. Ruiz says they stick together for protection.
I haven't been here in 15 years. No one feels safe in Mexico with all the crime. In the U.S., they speak so badly about Mexico, and more so of the border cities.
The deportees don't trust strangers, but they do trust each other, says Alejandro Mota.
We're never alone. Every time we go to the store to buy something, we go together and we come back here. No one knows anyone here. We have nowhere else to go.
Mota is standing outside the bus station with dozens of other deportees, eating bread and coffee donated by a local Catholic church. The church also sponsors the local migrant shelter. It's the only shelter in town, even though there were more than 62,000 deportations here last year. Teresa Delgadillo Resendiz runs the shelter.
Here we give the immigrants food, a change of clothes, and a place to stay while they try to get in touch with their relatives.
Delgadillo says she can accommodate up to 200 deportees who are returned to Matamoros. She advises them not to leave unless it's absolutely necessary.
There's a lot of violence on the streets. They've grabbed immigrants and they've beaten them badly.
During the 2 days I spent in Matamoros, I realized just how dangerous the city really is. When I interview the deportees eating breakfast, another man who claims to be an immigrant starts asking me who I am and why I'm taking photos. My driver, Samuel Lopez, who's worked with many journalists in dangerous parts of Mexico, says something seems off.
Because if he was a real deportee, he wouldn't have a backpack and a cell phone, and he had both.
But that isn't our only warning. At the shelter, two state workers insist that we leave. They say it's just too risky to stay. Samuel tells me we should take their advice.
Creo que cuando empiezan a decir que tengas mucho cuidado, que tengas cuidado, que tengas cuidado.
I think that when people start telling you, be very careful, be careful, be careful, that's a big sign, and you realize that if someone tells you it's time to go, it's time to go.
E insistieron, es porque hay que ir.
I cut my reporting short by one day. As I'm finishing up, I think about the options that could help these guys. Congress is considering a bill that would end nighttime deportations. And the Department of Homeland Security has started a program to send deportees directly to Mexico City, which is safer. From a payphone near the International Bridge, I call one of the deportees at the shelter. He tells me that two men came looking for me. Thankfully, I'm already heading north. Unlike him, I can go back to the safety of Texas. For Latino USA, I'm Maria Inés Zamudio in Matamoros, Mexico.
Support for this story was provided by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Coming up, a Chicano musical mystery from 1950s Los Angeles.
He's somebody whose voice wove its way into the lives of people. And so he became more of a kind of cultural emblem than an entertainer.
The music of the Chicano rock Bigfoot. Next on Latino USA. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now, a little music. Gene Aguilera has been looking for a musician named Little Julian Herrera for a long time. He had a fresh lead when he got an email from someone in San Diego. The guy said he'd found Little Julian and even put Gene on the phone with him.
And it didn't sound like Little Julian. I mean, I was asking him questions and he didn't really snap to the answer.
They emailed Gene a photo, but the photo didn't look like Julian.
When I pressed for more details, like, because I know Little Julian had a couple tattoos on his left arm, I said, take a picture of his left arm and send it to me. And it never happened. The whole thing went cold.
Little Julian Herrera wasn't just any musician. He was the first Chicano R&B heartthrob. Only he had a secret, and it's kept people interested in him for years. Alex Schmidt dives into the mystery.
There are lots of legends about Little Julian Herrera, like the one that says he was murdered in LA's Elysian Park, or that he's not well, hanging onto a job at a gas station in National City, California. I almost would not have believed he was real if I hadn't talked to people who knew him personally. Oh, and there's also this concrete piece of existence, his music.
This is his first single right here.
That's collector Gene Aguilera again. We're in his meticulously appointed garage, covered in custom-made wooden shelves that are filled with more than 10,000 records. Gene's focus is on Chicano music and the music of East LA. Among his rare pieces is the record we're listening to now, Lonely, Lonely Nights, Little Julian Herrera's first single. It was released in 1956, 2 years before Ritchie Valens released his first single. Odds are you've never heard of Little Julian Herrera, but in certain circles, the man is infamous.
Every time I would talk to a musician, every time I would talk to a collector, no joke, within the first minute or two of our conversation, they would say, hey, you ever heard of Little Julian?
That's Josh Kuhn. He calls Little Julian Herrera the Bigfoot of Chicano music, which is his area of expertise as a writer and researcher at USC. And just like people have tried to spot Bigfoot, there's a search on for Little Julian Herrera. But let's go back to the beginning. Little Julian's Los Angeles story starts somewhere near here, in the Boyle Heights neighborhood east of the LA River. Like I've said, a lot about his past is unclear. But here's Gene Aguilera to sum up the legend of his arrival in L.A.
He hitchhiked across the United States and ended up in Boyle Heights when he was 13. He got taken in by a Latino family in Boyle Heights whose last name was Herrera, and he assumed that last name of Herrera.
A few years later, Julian was a teenager. Mexican-American music was starting to emerge with an identity all its own. He might have grown up hearing Don Tosti's Pachuco Boogie or the father of Chicano music, Lalo Guerrero. East LA had a rock and music scene, and Julian hung around. He met a few people, started performing, and soon he was recording his own songs.
Like when I first heard Little Julian, I go, wow, you know, this guy's a Chicano guy. I mean, Little Julian Herrera. And he's playing all the venues around here, El Monte Legion Stadium, playing up and down Whittier Boulevard. And I mean, I could relate to him, you know, he was one of us, you know.
Julian sang with swagger. His songs embodied the emerging lowrider culture of East LA and the romantic nights at clubs along the boulevard. He had become a celebrity in his own neighborhood.
Hello. Hi, I made it.
Hi, come on in.
Thank you so much.
There aren't many people left who actually knew Little Julian Herrera. One of them is vibes player Gil Rocha, whose tidy house is in Lancaster, about an hour north of L.A. In 1958, Gil was the first bandleader to hire Ritchie Valens. Rocha would head to East L.A. several nights a week to get a piece of the action.
The East L.A. crowd seemed to really enjoy our music. There was times when they closed the place up, they wouldn't let us quit playing. They insisted we would keep on playing. And they just seemed to party all night long. A lot of times I was so tired, and these people I didn't even know was, hey, come on over to my house. Hey, you can stay overnight with us. And I did. And the next morning, the mother would come out and make tortillas and breakfast for us. And just like I was one of their sons. And that's the way all the people, the really good people in East L.A. are.
One night, Gil Rocha was playing a gig at the Calypso Inn in East L.A. when an unexpected guest walked through the door.
Julian Herrera showed up and he said, "Hi, everybody, I'm Julian Herrera." I grabbed the microphone and the leader just stood and looked at him. And he says, "Yeah, I'm going to sing you a song." And everybody stood up and kind of stopped and looked because they knew who he was. So he sang a typical, whatever was popular song of the day there, jumped off the stage and started dancing. And it was really, to the people who was the audience there, had never seen anything like this type of performance.
Was it at all like Elvis Presley?
No. It was wilder. Because he had the floor to himself, so he used the whole floor to do a circle around the floor as he danced around. And the people, he'd go by the people and wave at him as he danced, and they'd wave back at him. And the girls were really really impressed with what he was doing because it was so different for that era.
Rocha pulls out a black and white photo he took of that moment. Little Julian is standing alone on the dance floor with the band backing him on stage above. The photo's a little blurry, but Julian's facial expression is ecstatic, almost hypnotized.
I was sitting there watching him. I was looking at his face. When he'd spin around, he had this big smile on his face and his big eyes looking around and making sure everybody was enjoying what he was doing. And they were.
That same solo and dance routine happened 3 or 4 times at the Calypso Inn while Gil was playing. As much as Julian enjoyed the stage, he loved to party. After the wild show was done, he'd reap his reward.
After he got through there, he jumped into the crowd and started shaking hands and talking to him. Of course, he was getting a lot of free beers from this. I think that's what he was really doing.
During the era when Little Julian was coming up, DJ Art LeBeau was hosting near-weekly shows at the El Monte Legion Stadium.
I used to bring him over to the microphone with me and say, "Hey, everybody, here's Little Julian Herrera." And people would, you know, the girls would all start screaming in the front row, and he would grin from ear to ear, you know, and just kind of wave and all that. And I remember one day he was walking away, dancing away, sort of off to the off stage. It was just one step away from us shooing him off. I noticed there was a pint of booze tucked into his back pocket in jeans. And I remember just that picture comes to my mind.
In the middle of this period of fame and partying, a cop shows up at the home of Little Julian's record producer, legendary R&B musician Johnny Otis. The cop was looking for a Caucasian man named Ronald Wayne Gregory. The photo he showed Otis, it was of Little Julian Herrera, and he was wanted for rape. Johnny Otis learned that Little Julian was, in fact, a Hungarian Jew from the East Coast. L.A. court records with any amount of detail pertaining to the incident are confidential. But here's what we know. Little Julian, or Ronald Gregory, was convicted, along with 2 co-defendants, of a rape that took place in Griffith Park. The victim was 17 years old. Julian was 19. The co-defendants were convicted of statutory rape. Julian's crime was forcible rape. He was sent to jail and took a long break from the stage. Little Julian's arrest provided the first real crack in the portrait he'd created for himself. But even before that, there had been hints that something wasn't quite right.
He smiled a lot. You know, he seemed to be happy in his skin, as the saying goes. And he didn't seem to have a job or anything. He was a little hard to find. You know, he didn't really have a phone number. And you'd see him when you see him, you know. He just seemed to kind of bounce along, you know, through life, and a lot of us wish we could do that.
Yeah, Julian Herrera was bouncing through life, but on a much deeper level than LeBeau imagined. He was bouncing through cities, through families, through identities. As unique as Little Julian Herrera's experience seems to be, it's actually not. Cultural passing happens pretty frequently in the music world. Maz Mesro was a Jewish jazz musician who married a black woman and famously declared himself a voluntary Negro. In L.A., during Little Julian's era, well-known DJ Huggy Boy was white, but blended into the Latino community. Even Julian Herrera's own record producer, Johnny Otis, mixed two cultures. He was born Greek, but lived comfortably in the African-American community around L.A.'s Central Avenue. Where Julian lived, 1950s East L.A. and Boyle Heights specifically, was a uniquely diverse melting pot. It was one of the earliest Jewish communities of Los Angeles, and also one of the first Chicano and Japanese communities. Say you're sorry, you'll make it up, and you'll come home. This is one of Julian's songs, You Will Cry. In most of his songs, when he sings in English, he seems to use the accent of a Spanish speaker. In this particular song, he goes for it and sings in Spanish. Little Julian took the cultural mixing a step further than most. He hid something. Even people who were close to him had little notion of it.
How are you?
Fine, sweetie.
I met sax player Bernie Garcia at a diner. Though Bernie and Julian were friends, it was news to him when I explained that Julian Herrera's name was not actually Julian Herrera.
Do you know anything about Little Julian's family or?
Nothing. Nothing. I never heard him talk about much except a few girls here and there. That was it.
Do you think he kept to himself about his personal life or it just never came up?
Yeah, I think he kept to himself about it. Because most musicians are open about stuff like that, and for whatever his reason was, yeah, it was personal to him.
After he got out of jail, Little Julian sought out the adoring crowds once again. He played shows, recorded new songs, but things did not go well. There are rumors that Julian was drinking and violent, that he slept several nights in the basement of the El Monte Legion Stadium. One day, in 1963, Julian called up his friend Bernie.
In fact, he told me he had some legal problems and he had to get out of town for a while. I said, yeah, it makes sense.
Julian had set up a series of gigs in Tijuana and asked Bernie to join him. Bernie said yes. After a wild week of performing and partying, he decided it was time to head home. He didn't know it at the time, but this exchange would be the last confirmed sighting of Little Julian Herrera.
After I left the gig, he called me up and asked me if I wanted to reconsider, and I said, no, I'm going to pass, pal, you know. That was it. I haven't heard from him since. I wish he were still alive. I'd love to see him.
Music collector Gene Aguilera and others are trying to find Little Julian Herrera. If he's alive, he would be 74 years old. Whether he knew them personally or not, Little Julian had a lasting impact on many. USC's Josh Kuhn again.
He's somebody whose voice wove its way into the lives of people, whose voice became part of a soundtrack to a community. And so he became more of a kind of cultural emblem than an entertainer.
That may be truer for Gene Aguilera than anyone else.
You know, if I found him, I think my soul would be at peace because it's been such a long time that I've been looking for him.
For Latino USA, I'm Alex Schmidt in Los Angeles.
And now time for a bocadito, a little morsel of news. One of our favorites from last year that caught our eyes, or actually our nose. It smells like freshly cooked tamales, savory pork blending with the sweetness of corn. And now you can take that scent out of the kitchen and wear it. A Chicago perfume maker has created a line of scented oils that smell like typical Latin foods. Soraida Ortiz calls her line of perfumes La 18 after 18th Street, the main road in the Mexican neighborhood of Pilsen in Chicago, where she lives. Besides tamales, Ortiz also makes oils that smell like horchata, a sweet rice drink, and pan de muerto, the sweet bread used during the Mexican Day of the Dead celebration. She also honors her own Puerto Rican heritage with oils for, get this, lechon asado, or roast pork, and the canepa fruit. Ortiz sells her oils in a couple of shops on 18th Street. Before she creates one, she closes her eyes and meditates on it. And then?
Essentially, it comes out of me as sort of the same way an artist would create a work of art on a canvas. My art specifically is inside of a bottle.
Some people might think it's odd to wear a perfume that smells like food. Ortiz says the purpose isn't to make you hungry, but to make others hunger for you.
The idea behind it is for you to smell so good that someone, your object of desire, someone who you have a crush on will smell you and think of the kitchen and have their brain cells think of food and fall in love with you.
Ortiz donates part of her profits to a charity called Feeding America, and that, you guessed it, makes sense. And that's it for this week. Happy New Year. Feliz Año Nuevo, mis queridos. I hope you have, and we all have, a great 2014. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to the folks at the Unfictional Podcast at KCRW for our Chicano Rock Bigfoot story. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Wouldn't it be lovely, 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 lovely.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.